Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinions, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Ricky Solinger will be on to talk about her new book, Explaining Reproductive Rights. Will Salton shows us the parts of Live Action's video that you didn't take hours to watch, and Pat Robertson reminds us that the religious right is just plain sexist. Representative Kevin Cramer of North Dakota made one of the weirder anti-choice arguments I've heard in a while.
40 years ago, the United States Supreme Court sanctioned abortion on demand, and we wonder why our culture sees school shootings so often.
Of course, the overall murder rate has gone down in that time. If legalized abortion caused one, then it would cause the other, right? Complete and total credit to Will Salatin of Slate for digging into the bizarre, dishonest videos made by Live Action that tried to frame various clinics that offer pre-viability abortions of choice as places that perform infanticide. The hope was that Live Action could catch another Gosnell, that is, someone who is performing illegal late-term abortions and then killing viable babies born alive. They did not, of course, find anyone like that. They didn't even find evidence of what anti-choicers always claim, which is that clinics are trying to sell unsure women of abortions. In fact, quite the opposite. Will Salton combed through the footage and found the stuff that Live Action edited out in this highlight video, assured by the knowledge that no one would actually bother to watch it. What he discovered was compassionate providers doing a thankless job out of deep compassion. Basically, a woman who was 23 weeks pregnant went into clinics to inquire about getting a legal abortion before viability. Most abortions at this stage are done for medically necessary reasons, and the clinic's response to having a woman ask for one done for choice was definitely not something Live Action included in the edit. But Salatin did.
You have to realize that this is a decision that unfortunately affects you deeply beyond anything, and one way or another, you have to live with that responsibility.
We're not going to use any of that footage, because it would show our audience that the people who work in these clinics are really about morality and responsibility, not about selling abortion.
Yep. As Salatin notes, the first clinic worker they talk to immediately tries to discourage her from rushing into an abortion decision and emphasizes how an abortion isn't a decision to take lightly. That, of course, went straight to the cutting room floor. Lila Rose continues to claim in public that she believes abortion clinics are trying to sell abortions, even to women who don't want them. But she herself collected evidence that shows the opposite is true. So we can no longer give her the benefit of the doubt about being ignorant and have to assume she's lying. The anti-choicer then tries asking the clinic worker 15 different ways if fetuses come out alive and are left to die. And sadly for her, the clinic worker says no over and over again.
So, like, when it comes out, like, does it, like, can it, like, move or anything?
No.
No. Okay. So, like, it's never happened that,
no,
like, breathing or,
yeah.
What if it, like, happened to,
no,
me, though?
Trust me, you won't.
So it's never happened, though, at this stage?
So far, no. So
okay.
Far, nothing like that.
No. You've never had?
Mm-mm.
Okay. You've never had a baby?
No.
She tries the same routine on the doctor. He also makes it clear that babies are not born alive in clinics and then left to die. But she's incredibly insistent that these workers tell her what they would do in this impossible instance of a baby being born alive and viable. On the cutting room floor, then, went clinic workers saying they would resuscitate, and on the very slim chance of a viable baby being born, they would suggest adoption. Cutting room floor, all of that. In the Bronx, they didn't have much more luck in trying to get someone to fit the anti-choice stereotype of providers pulling a Gosnell and tricking women into later-term abortions.
So are you sure that you want to do this termination? I mean, have you thought about this? When did you find out you were pregnant? Are you sure you want to do a termination? Because you knew that you were pregnant when you were 2 months. So
yeah.
There's somewhere or another you were thinking about continuing this pregnancy.
Yeah.
So what changed your mind from then to now?
Well, I don't really feel like talking about it.
Okay, I mean, you don't have to go into detail, but there has to be, is there something that can be rectified and then you want to continue this pregnancy? Because
Basically, she's trying to play an anti-choice stereotype of the dumb bimbo who waits around 5 months and then thinks, meh, I changed my mind. Why anti-choicers think that women so irresponsible, even if they really did exist, are ready to be mothers is beyond me, by the way. What she found was that the counselor doesn't actually get these patients because they exist only in the minds of anti-choicers, but not in the real world. Instead, the counselor's advice made it clear that when they see women coming in this late in their pregnancies, stuff is really going wrong for them and they need compassion and help and understanding. Oops. But as Salatin noted, easy enough to leave it on the cutting room floor. That's just a sampling of the professionalism, nuance, and compassion live action actually captured at abortion clinics, and then went on to deny and distort. Watch Salatin's entire video to see some of the rest. I'd like to welcome Ricky Salinger to the program. Ricky is a historian who focuses on the history and politics around reproductive health care and technologies, and she has a new book out, a primer on these many and varied issues called Reproductive Politics, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to RealityCast, Ricky.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, to promote your book, you recently had a piece in the Washington Post about the biggest myths regarding abortion. What do you think are the most widespread and damaging myths?
Well, for one thing, it's always been the anti-reproductive rights folks always talk about the about fetal rights, about the centrality of the fetus, diminishing a woman's rights, a woman's body. And actually, it's really interesting to see how recently the focus on the fetus has come into play. Also, another central myth is that in the old days, before abortion was legal, that women were always in danger, that all of the practitioners, all of the people who did criminal abortion were back alley butchers. And of course, this raises the issue of the Gosnell verdict. Dr. Gosnell in Philadelphia, who was just convicted of 3 counts of murder and various other crimes yesterday, and the role he plays in the imagination of anti-reproductive rights folks who say this, his conviction proves and his practice proves what a brutality abortion is. And of course, both before and after Roe, abortion has generally been done by people who knew what they were doing, did a good job, and caused very little mayhem of any kind. I mean, today we know that 1/3 of 1% of people who get abortions end up in a hospital. I mean, almost no one. Abortion is a very, very safe practice, and in fact, much safer for women than childbirth. You know, the idea that abortion practitioners are dangerous is a myth from beginning to end. Of course, it's always better to have a procedure that women, that hundreds of thousands, millions of women require being legal and being antiseptic and being done in a professional way. And one other myth, I just can't help mentioning one other myth. And I actually, at this very moment, I don't have all 5 of them at my fingertips, but one which is really at the center of reproductive politics and abortion rights and the right to contraception and all and the ability of women to manage their own bodies today is that all women face the same need to have access to choice. That is, that rich women, poor women, all women face the same problems in accessing and requiring the materials and the services necessary to be a full citizen, to be able to have access. And it actually, it just doesn't work that way. Middle-class women, women with resources now and in the past have always had access, much better access to services than women without resources. And so the issues are often very different and imagined and perceived and experienced very different by women with resources and women without.
And that's been true whether it's legal or not.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And certainly we know about the criminal era that women who had resources had private doctors, many of whom were willing to serve their private patients and provide abortions, provide access to contraceptive materials before they were legal, and provide services of many kinds. And poor women generally did not have access to private doctors. And, of course, we know today the difference between having access to health insurance or not makes a huge difference in whether a woman can get what she needs to achieve reproductive health and reproductive rights. We know that millions of women in the United States today don't have access to private doctors, don't have access to health insurance. And that makes a very different reproductive life, reproductive set of options than middle-class women have.
So one of the things I thought was really interesting about your book is you really definitely focus a lot on the history of these issues. And one of the topics that you cover is the struggle over, I hate to put it this way, but the struggle over Susan B. Anthony's legacy.
Mm.
You have a lot of anti-choicers citing her opposition to abortion as evidence that modern day feminists ought to also be against abortion. Can you kind of tell us what the truth is on this?
It's so frustrating because it's really helpful to be historically accurate, to actually get the story straight. It makes a difference. So when Susan B. Anthony and other 19th century first wave feminists spoke out against abortion, what they were concerned with was the separation of sex and conception and childbearing they felt was dangerous to women. If women could have sex and not fulfill their destiny, their only destiny, that is to be mothers, they stood the chance and they stood the likelihood of having their moral, their chastity undermined, their public reputations undermined, their sense of moral nobility harmed. And after all, in the 19th century, in the culture which assessed particularly white women standing in the community, sexual chastity and achieving motherhood were women's only routes and only claims to full dignity. So that's a very 19th century perspective on the meaning of female life. That is, sexual chastity is all. Achieving motherhood is all. So when contemporary Feminists for Life and other such groups say, we need to be like Susan B. Anthony and oppose abortion, what they're saying is hardly a feminist position. What they're saying is we need to return to a 19th century view of women where sexual chastity is all.
And as a historian, when would you say that shifted, that feminism shifted from being a movement interested in women's chastity to one saying that no, women should just be liberated sexually?
Well, I mean, I think it was a very, very long and gradual shift, which came into really powerful, intense focus in the 1960s. But certainly when we look at the rising rates of female employment, which may have hit new peaks during World War II, but also, you know, had been gradually rising across the 20th century with industrialization, with urbanization, as women moved away from living with their families and were employed. We certainly saw the need among women of all classes to have access to contraception and certainly access to abortion. I mean, this is one of the really interesting myths, and I can't remember if it was in the Washington Post group or not, but the idea that before 1973, before Roe v. Wade, that the United States was a relatively abortion-free country, and that Roe v. Wade opened the floodgates and suddenly all these abortions occurred. Well, I mean, it's really interesting that all the experts, the people who watched public health issues and doctors and hospitals and police records and so on, all of that aggregated shows that there were probably between 1 and 2 million, and actually, interestingly, the most commonly cited number in the pre-Roe period was about 1.2 million abortions performed every year, something over a million. And these were mostly done in secret. Some of them were done as therapeutic abortions in hospitals, but many, many done in secret were qualified as criminal abortions. And today, the number of abortions performed every year is about 1.2 million. So, you know, this shows that women must feel that they must be able to control their bodies, that they have historically done whatever it has taken to control their own bodies, whether it means going to somebody who has no business doing an abortion, but does it because it's a way to make money and trades on women's vulnerability and their need, which was not uncommon in the criminal era, or whether they were able to go to a private doctor or a trained and well-trained midwife or some other community person who could do it well. But in any case, it's a notable fact that women have gotten abortions before, and they before it was legal, and they will always. And the question is, will the United States, to what degree will religious conviction against abortion prevail in the United States and other issues involving reproduction? Who has the right to be a parent? In what ways does sexual orientation give people rights or no rights? And what does religion have to do with it? Or in what ways do issues of human rights structure these questions, and how do these play out in the political arena? Many unresolved.
Yeah, and what I like about your book is that you have it as a question-answer format, so it's much more information sharing than it is really a polemical book.
Well, this is a series that Oxford University Press does, and they've done books about global food politics and China and the Arab uprisings and many, many subjects. And, you know, they say to the authors of these books, write for an educated public that understands how to grapple with paradoxes and understands how to deal with issues which are not clear and not resolved. But they sort of say these books are not supposed to be political. But it's really hard to write about issues of who gets to be a mother in the United States, who gets to make these decisions, what are the problems with choice, what are the problems with this rubric of choice, and not be political, but try to be judicious and try to be even-handed and present the politics of both sides. But after all, I'm a person who is a partisan of reproductive justice. I long ago saw the problems with the concept of choice, how politically it was very successful in creating some women as good choice makers in the United States, that is, women with enough money to have health insurance or to have private doctors, to be able to control their fertility, to have good health care, and on the other hand, defining a large group of women in the United States as the source of all problems in this culture and as bad choice makers because they had no business having children if they didn't have enough money. So choice, actually, after it emerged as the sort of hallmark of modern womanhood, that is, women who could function in society as competent, responsible, modern women had the right to make choices, and other women had no business making choices in this domain. They should, and actually, you know, we see this so clearly in the simultaneous passing of the Hyde Amendment, which said that no federal dollars will be used for abortion, at the same time that we see the punishment of poor women who had children by threatening to or removing them from welfare rolls. So if they had a child or if they tried not to have a child, poor women in the United States were targets of public policy. And the only conclusion that conclusions that one could draw were that on the one hand, the polity, politicians and policymakers were interested in controlling these women and controlling them in a way that would deny and remove their lives as sexual persons if the punishments went in both directions.
My guest today has been Ricky Solinger. Her book is called Reproductive Politics, What Everyone Needs to Know. I highly recommend buying it and then sharing it with anyone you know who has questions or really needs to bone up on the issues here. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Ricky.
Thank you, Amanda. Bye.
Bye. I got love for you if you were born in the 80s. One of the most fascinating things about the modern religious right is the two-faced way they have of promoting their agenda. If they're in the political sphere, claims about sexual and reproductive health policy are usually carefully constructed to avoid discussion about gender roles or sexuality. Everything is about fetal life, their weird definition of religious liberty that results in employers being able to take yours away, or fallacious claims that contraception is the same thing as abortion. But in the intra-religious right-wing media, when they're doing things like giving advice or discussing ethics, all of a sudden the belief that women are inferior to men, women are a servant class for men, and women's sexuality needs to be tightly constrained while men are just uncontrollable beasts comes roaring out. All this became evident recently on the 700 Club, Pat Robertson's clearing ground for the past few decades for everything religious right. A viewer wrote in with a question.
Ivy writes in and says, I've been trying to forgive my husband for cheating on me. We've gone to counseling, but I just can't seem to forgive, nor can I trust. How do you let go of anger, and how do you trust again? God says to forgive, but it's been so hard to do. I want to forgive so we can get on with our lives.
Robertson, who was instrumental in kicking off the anti-choice movement and generally has been a stalwart believer that women should be punished in every way possible, had a completely different take when it came to male cheating. Women who have sex, in his world, should not even have the basic right to say no to an unwanted pregnancy, even if they weren't cheating, even if they're married, because female sexuality is that evil. But men shouldn't even have to endure their wife's anger, no matter how justified.
Stop talking about the cheating. He cheated on you. Well, he's a man. Okay. So what you do is begin to focus on why you married him in the first place. On what he does good. Does he provide a home for you to live in? Does he provide food for you to eat? Does he provide clothes for you to wear? Is he nice to the children? Do you have a happy family? Does he take the kids to sporting events? Does he go out and watch their little league games? Does he share with you stuff that's going on? And is he handsome or is he, you know, what is it?
Love how he just assumes that women are dependent on men, as if we're not allowed to have jobs. While women and gays in his world are expected to contain their sexual desires no matter how wholesome and non-harmful and loving they are, the same is not expected of straight men. When straight men act out, even in ways that are legitimately harmful, the fault is always someone else's, usually a woman's, such as his wife, who drove him to cheat with her poor housekeeping.
So think about those things and give him honor instead of trying to worry about it. But recognize also, like it or not, males have a tendency to wander a little bit. And what you want to do is to make a home so wonderful that he doesn't want to wander.
That goes a previous statement made by Robertson where male cheating was blamed not on men making poor choices, but women's clothing.
You always have to keep that spark of love alive. It just isn't something to just lie there. Well, I'm married to him, so he's got to take me slatternly looking. You've got to fix yourself up, look pretty, look alert.
This time out, not only was the male choice to cheat blamed on women's poor housekeeping, but also pornography.
Think of the temptations that are out there. The internet is filled with pornography. Magazines are filled with pictures, salacious pictures of women. You look anywhere you turn around, there's some solicitation to the senses to entice a man. And so what you have to do is say, my husband was captured, and I want to get him free.
So there you have it. Men cannot be blamed for cheating because it's always about women's looks or housekeeping or the culture at large. But women's sexual choices are extremely narrow. Not only are we not to cheat, of course, but we're not to have consensual premarital sex or even deliberately non-procreative sex within marriage. Just your weekly reminder that this isn't and never was about religious liberty, fetal life, or anything like that. Just rigid gender roles and a continuation of religious patriarchy. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Violent threats stage of right-wing nuttery edition. Pete Santelli has raised his profile in right-wing circles lately by bringing on popular pro-gun folks, and so Right Wing Watch has put him on their list of folks to watch. And he recently said this.
Miss Hillary Clinton needs to be convicted. She needs to be tried, convicted, and shot in the vagina. I want to pull the trigger.
The gross misogyny that's always been lurking in the ranks of gun fanaticism has really gotten worse since a gun nut shot up a school and killed only women and children in the process.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.